The last words were not an empty phrase. He believed that every village in Japan knew of his loyal behavior, and he could visualize word of his deportment creeping to his parents' home. And he could see how happy they were that their son was a decent Japanese. All Japan was proud of him, and for Kamijiro, that was sufficient. For 13 years, he lived in this manner, excited by his recurring contacts with Japan, and hopeful that one day soon he would accumulate the $400 plus the boat fare home. But one spring day in 1915, when the casuarina trees were throwing bright nodules at the tips of their needles, ready for the year's growth, and when blossoms were coming onto the pineapples nestling in the red earth, Kamijiro heard a bird cry. It was not a seabird, for he knew their voices as they swept aloft on the spume thrown up by the cliffs. Perhaps it was from Tahiti, where it had been wintering. Possibly it was merely crossing Kauai on its way to Alaska for the rich, insect-laden summer months. And Kamijiro never actually saw the bird, but he heard it winging past him, and he stopped dead in the middle of the pineapple field and thought, "I am 33 years old, and the years are flying past me." He entered into a period of terrible depression, and a vision came to him which he could not expel. He saw Yoko waiting in Hiroshima beside the rice fields, and birds were flying past her, too. And she held out her hands, and mists came from the inland sea and obliterated her pleading. For the first time, he did not rise at 3:30, and he failed to tend his hot baths, throwing the job onto a friend. He wandered about, gnawed at by an insatiable hunger, and he contemplated going to Kapa'a on the brothels, but he rejected the idea, and at last he worked himself toward the decision that hundreds had made before him. "For a little while, I shall forget about returning to Japan, but I will use my money to send for Yoko." He was hoeing pineapple when he made this decision, and it was only 2 o'clock in the afternoon. But he dropped his hoe and walked in a kind of glorious daze out to the main highway and on into Kapa'a, where the ostracized Hashimoto had a photograph shop and an agency for ships traveling to Japan. Smothering his pride and approaching the renegade, Kamijiro said, "I want to get my picture taken to send to Japan." "Go home and shave," Hashimoto said bluntly, "and wear the dark suit." "I have no suit." "Ishii Camp has one. All the men use it." "I don't want to wear a borrowed suit." "What girl will want to marry you if you send a photograph without a dark suit?" "Who said anything about girls?" "Obviously, you want to get married. I'm glad for you and will take a fine picture. But shave first and wear the dark suit." "How much will it all cost?" Kamijiro asked. "Photograph, $3. Boat fare for the girl, 70. Her train expenses and dresses and the feast back home, maybe 70. Total, $143. Such an amount would delay the accumulation of $400 by another 3 or 4 years at least, and Kamijiro hesitated. "I don't know about that," he said. "Please don't tell anybody." "I take pictures. I talk to nobody." "I may be back," Kamijiro said. "You will be," Hashimoto predicted. Then, as he did with all the Japanese who had ostracized him, he added brutally, "You will marry the girl, and you will never return to Japan. Make up your mind about that." Kamijiro swallowed hard and avoided looking at the photographer. "I am going back to Japan," he said. "You have done me a favor, Hashimoto-san. For a moment, I was hungry for a wife and thought, I will spend my money that way. But you have shown me what that means. Good night. I won't be back." But as he left the photographer's store, a brood of children, half Japanese, half Hawaiian, swept past him, shouting in a language that no man living could understand. The wild, sweet pigeon of childhood, composed of all languages, and they bumped into him, and a little girl, her hair cut square in the Japanese fashion, cried, "Gomenasai!" And on the impulse of the moment, Kamajiro stooped and caught the child, bringing her face to his, and for an instant she remained limp in his arms. Then she kicked free and cried in Hawaiian and Portuguese, "I must go with the others." And from the doorway, Hashimoto, still hating the men who had driven him out, laughed and said, "It was my daughter you were holding. I have 6 children, 4 of them boys." In great agitation, Kamajiro walked home, and the smell of the little girl's hair burned his nostrils, so that when he reached the camp and saw the long, bleak, womanless barracks in which he had been living for 13 years, he rushed directly to Ishii-san and said, "You must write a letter home." "Are you thinking of getting married?" the scribe asked, for he recognized the symptoms. "Yes." Unexpectedly, the thin little letter writer grasped Kamajiro's hand and confided, "I have been thinking the same thing. What would it cost?" "Not much," Kamajiro cried excitedly. "Photograph, $3. Fare, 70. Maybe 143 altogether." "I am going to do it," Ishii-san announced. "I have been thinking about it all this year." "So have I," Kamajiro confessed, and he sat upon the floor as Ishii-san got out his brushes. "Dear mother, I have decided to take a wife, and later I will send you my photograph so that you can show it to Yoko-chan and she can see how I look now. When you tell me that she is willing to come to Hawaii, I will send the money. This does not mean that I am not going to come back home. It only means that I shall stay here a little longer. Your faithful son, Kamajiro." It took 9 weeks to receive an answer to this letter, and when it arrived, Kamajiro was stunned by its contents, for his mother wrote, "You must be a stupid boy to think that Yoko-chan would still be waiting. She got married 12 years ago and already has 5 children, 3 of them sons. What made you suppose that a self-respecting girl would wait? But that is no loss, for, as you can see, I am sending you the photograph of a very fine young lady named Sumiko, who has said that she would marry you. She is from this village and will make a lovely wife. Please send the money." A photograph, 4 inches by 3, fluttered to the bed, face down. For several moments, Kamajiro allowed it to lie there, unable to comprehend that when he turned it over, it would show not Yoko, whom he had kept enshrined in his memory, but some girl he had never known. Gingerly, and with 2 fingers, he lifted the edge of the picture and dropped his head sideways to peer at it. Suddenly, he flipped it over and shouted, "Oh, look at this beautiful girl! Look at her!" A crowd gathered to study the photograph, and some protested, "That girl will never marry a clod like you, Kamajiro." "Tell them what the letter says," Kamajiro instructed Ishii-san, and the scribe read aloud the facts of the case. The girl's name was Sumiko, and she was willing to marry Kamajiro. "Is she a Hiroshima girl?" a suspicious man inquired. "She's from Hiroshima Ken," Kamajiro replied proudly, and a sigh of contentment rose from the long bunkhouse. On one person, the photograph of Kamajiro's good luck had a depressing effect, for in an earlier mail, Ishii-san had received a picture of the bride his parents had picked for him. She was a girl called Mori Yoriko, which was a pleasing name, but her photograph showed her to be one of those square-faced, stolid, pinch-eyed peasant girls that Japan seemed to produce in unlimited numbers. Ishii-san's mother assured him that Mori Yoriko could work better than a man and saved money. But the scribe felt that there was more to marriage than that, especially when, as in his case, the husband could read and write. He was patently disappointed and asked to see Kamajiro's picture again. Sumiko, as he studied her, appeared to have the classic type of beauty. Gently slanted eyes, fine cheekbones, low forehead, pear-shaped face, and delicate features. She looked like the girls whose pictures were painted on the sheets advertising Japanese historical movies, and Ishii-san said, "She's very pretty for a Hiroshima girl. Maybe she's from the city." "No," Kamajiro assured him, My mother would never send a city girl. The next day, the two would-be husbands borrowed Ishii Camp's publicly owned black suit, the tie that went with it, and the white shirt. They wrapped their treasure in a sheet, hired a taxi, and drove into Kapa'a, where Hashimoto the photographer told them, "Take turns with the suit and be sure to comb your hair." When Kamajiro climbed into the strange clothes, Hashimoto had to show him how to tie the tie, after which the stocky field hand plastered his hair down with a special grease Hashimoto provided for that purpose. Kamajiro then moved into range of the camera, posing rigidly and refusing to smile. The finished picture, even though it was properly styled and mounted, would have excited few prospective brides, and Hashimoto did not consider it one of his best. Nevertheless, Kamajiro mailed it with a fully paid ticket from Tokyo to Honolulu. Then he waited. In late 1915, Ishii-san and Kamajiro received notice that their brides were arriving at Honolulu on the old Japanese freighter Kyoto Maru. The news did not occasion the joy that might have been expected, because it had been hoped at the camp that the two girls might arrive by separate ships, for then each husband, when he went to get his wife, could have worn the black suit, thus corresponding to the photograph sent to Japan. As things now stood, one man would wear the suit and not disappoint his bride, but the other would clearly have to wear his laboring clothes and stand before his bride as he really was. It was the character of Kamajiro to say quickly to his friend, "Since you can read and write, it is proper for you to wear the suit." And the camp agreed that this was the only logical solution. The lovers, alternately ardent and afraid, left Lihue by the small ship Kilauea and went to Honolulu, where they took one room in a dingy Japanese inn on Hotel Street. Since they arrived on the evening before the Kyoto Maru was expected, they ate a meager supper of rice and fish, then hiked up Nuuanu and bowed low before the symbol of their emperor. As they were doing so, an official in black cutaway hustled out on some important meeting and snapped, "Don't stand around here like peasants. Go about your work." Obediently, the men left. They were impressed by the big homes on Baratania Street, but were shocked by the dirty alleys of Chinatown, where one miserable hovel leaned against the next. Ishii-san said, "They told me that 15 years ago this whole neighborhood was burned down, and the Chinese wanted to rebuild it like a proper city, without alleys and mean houses. But the white people wanted it the way it was before, so it was built that way again." The two men, recalling the clean roads and immaculate homes of their childhood, shook their heads at the white man's ways. Before they went to sleep that night, Ishii-san spread before him the two photographs, and he spent a long time comparing them, and his disappointment at the tricks of fate became apparent in his features. "My mother didn't choose very well, I'm afraid," he said. "Isn't it strange, Kamajiro, to think that a great ship out there is bringing a woman with whom you will spend the rest of your life?" "I'm nervous," Kamajiro confessed. But his nervousness that night was nothing to what he would experience during the next days. For when the Kyoto Maru docked, the seven Japanese men who had come to meet their picture brides were told, "We never let the women out of quarantine for 3 days." "Can't we even see them?" Ishii-san implored. "No contact of any kind," the immigration man warned. Later, the ardent grooms found that if they bribed one of the attendants, they could press their faces against a hole the size of a half dollar that had been bored into the door behind which the incoming brides were imprisoned, and the third man in line was Kamajiro. Squinting, so as to make his eyes smaller, he peered through the miserable peephole and saw seven women idly sitting and standing in groups. He looked from one to the other and was unable to detect which was Sumiko, and he looked back beseechingly at the guard who spoke no Japanese. Applying his eye once more to the circle, he looked avidly at the seven women. But again, he could not isolate his intended wife. And in some confusion, he turned the peephole over to his successor. "Is she beautiful?" Ishii-san asked. "Very," Kamajiro assured him. "Did you see Yoriko?"
"I think so."
"Does she look pretty good?"
"She looks very healthy," Kamajiro said.
When Ishii-san left the peephole, he was trembling. "She's a lot bigger than I am," he mumbled. "Damn my mother."
"Oh, Ishii-san," Kamajiro protested. "She's a Hiroshima girl. She's bound to make a good wife."
On the second and third days, the men returned to spy upon their wives. And by a process of elimination, Kamajiro discovered whom he was to marry. He had failed at first to find her, because she was, by all odds, the loveliest of the girls, and he had not been able to believe that she was intended for him. Commiserating with his friend Ishii-san's disappointment, he had the delicacy not to revel in the beauty of his own wife. But as the hours passed, leading up to the moment when the doors would be thrown open, he became frightfully nervous and excited.
"I am beginning to feel sick," he told Ishii-san.
"I already am," the letter writer confided.
"I think I may go away and come back later," Kamajiro whispered.
"Wait a minute," one of the husbands snapped. "Look at the poor women." Kamajiro felt himself shoved to the peephole, and for the last time he saw the seven brides. They knew that the hour of meeting was at hand, and the bravery that had marked their earlier behavior now fled. Without adequate water or combs, they made pathetic attempts to pretty themselves. They smoothed down one another's rumpled, sea-worn dresses and tucked in ends of hair. One woman applied her fingertips to her forehead as if she considered it ugly, and tried to spread its skin more smoothly over the heavy bones. In the corner, one girl wept, and after a brief attempt at trying to console her, the others left her alone with her misery. But there was one thing that each girl in her final moments of panic did. She studied the photograph clutched in her hand and desperately tried to memorize the features of the man she was about to meet. She was determined that she would know him and that she would walk up to him unerringly and bow before him. But now, all were weeping and the photographs were blurred. A gong rang, and Kamajiro jumped back from the door. Slowly the hinges swung open, and the brides came forth. No tears were visible. The placid faces under the mounds of black hair looked steadily, inquiringly forward, and the first sound heard was a muffled gasp of pain.
"Oh," one of the brides sighed, "you are so much older than the picture."
"It was taken a long time ago," the man explained. "But I will be a good husband." He held out his hand, and the girl, controlling herself, bowed until her head almost touched his knees. They formed the first pair. The next girl, the one who had been weeping alone in the corner, walked straight to her man, smiled, and bowed low. "I am Fumiko," she said. "Your mother sends a thousand blessings." And she formed up the second pair. The third girl was Mori Yoriko, Ishii-san's bride, and as he had feared, she was much more robust than he. She was a true Hiroshima country girl, red-cheeked, square-faced, squint-eyed. Knowing that she was less beautiful than any of the others, she made up for her deficiencies in stalwart courage and a burning desire to make herself into a good wife. She found Ishii-san and bowed low, her big hands held close to her knees. "Mr. Ishii," she whispered, "I bring you the love of your mother." Then, as if she knew reassurance was necessary, she quickly added in a halting whisper, "I will be a good wife." The last girl to find her husband was Sumiko, the prettiest of the lot, and her recalcitrance sprang not from any lack of wit, but from the shock she had received when she first saw Kamajiro. He did not wear the black suit in which he had been photographed, nor was his hair pasted down.
His clothes were those of a mean peasant, and his arms were brutally awkward. He was grim-faced, like an angry, stupid man, and he was twice as old as she had expected. Last in line, and with only one man unattached, Sumiko obviously knew who her husband was, but she refused to accept the fact. "No," she cried imperiously, "that one is not my man." "Oh," Kamajiro gasped, "I am Sakagawa Kamajiro. I have your picture." She slapped it from his hand and then threw hers upon it, stamping upon them. "I will not marry this man. I have been deceived." At this outburst, the first bride, who had also found a husband she did not want, shook Sumiko and cried in rapid Japanese, "Control yourself, you selfish little fool. In such an affair, who expects to find a champion?" "I will not marry this animal," Sumiko wailed. Whereupon the first bride, who had gracefully accepted her disappointment, delivered a solid slap across the girl's face. "On the entire trip, you were a mean, nasty child. You ought to be ashamed. Go to that good man and humble yourself before him." The first bride placed her hand in the middle of Sumiko's back and projected her across the hushed immigration room. Sumiko would have stumbled, except that from the astonished couples, Ishii-san sprang forth to rescue her. He caught her by the waist and held her for a moment. Then, looking at Kamajiro and his own intended bride, he said with a frankness that startled even himself, "Kamajiro, you and Yoriko make a better pair. Give me Sumiko." And the beautiful girl, finding herself in the presence of a cultured man who wore a black suit, suddenly cried, "Yes, Kamajiro, you are too old for me. Please, please." In stolid bewilderment, Kamajiro looked down at the picture and recalled how deeply over the past months he had grown to love it. Then he looked up at square-faced, chap-cheeked Mori Yoriko and thought, "She is not the girl in the picture. What are they doing to me?" He hesitated, the room whirling about him, and then he felt on his arm the hand of the first bride who had slapped Sumiko, and this quiet-voiced girl was saying, "I do not know your name, but I have lived with Yoriko for 3 weeks, and of all the brides here, I assure you that she will make the best wife. Take her." The humiliated country girl, who had been so painfully rejected by her intended husband, found tears welling into her unpretty eyes, and she wanted to run to some corner. But she stood firm, like the rock from which she had been hewn, and bowed low before the stranger. "I will be a good wife," she mumbled, fighting to control her voice. Kamajiro looked for the last time at the well-remembered picture on the floor, then picked it up and handed it to his friend Ishii-san. "It will be better this way," he said. Returning to the girl who still bowed, he said gently, "My name is Sakagawa Kamajiro. I am from Hiroshima Ken." "My name is Mori Yoriko," the peasant girl answered. "I also am from Hiroshima." "Then we will get married," he said. And the seven couples were completed. During the years when Kamajiro Sakagawa and his bride Yoriko were discovering how lucky they were to have stumbled into their improvised marriage, the missionary families in Honolulu were experiencing a major shock.